This is similar to the question of whether political democracy requires economic development as a precondition. The answer to the latter question informs the answer to the first. Historically, democracy has followed the Industrial Revolution and the rise in incomes, but there is no reason to think countries cannot become democratic at much earlier levels of development. Political participation and contestation are intrinsic values. They also serve an instrumental purpose. Empirical research has established that democratic governments possibly perform better than authoritarian regimes and produce greater stability on top. Two shining models of democracy in low-income settings exemplify the point: India and Mauritius. These two countries differ greatly in size, but they are both highly heterogeneous countries that were born amid ethnic strife and violence. In both cases, democracy early on has tempered social conflict and enabled political stability. Mauritius grew rapidly 7 years after independence. India's growth performance lagged until the 1980s, but has been more than decent since, even overtaking China in recent years. Similarly, there is no reason why workers in low-income countries should be deprived of fundamental labor rights for the sake of industrial development and export performance. These include freedom of association and collective bargaining, reasonably safe working conditions, non-discrimination, maximum hours, and restrictions on arbitrary dismissal. As with democracy, these are basic requirements of a decent society. Their first-order effect is to level the bargaining relationship between employers and employees rather than raise overall costs of production. And even when costs are affected, any adverse effect could be easily offset by improved morale, better incentives, and reduced turnover of the workforce. Minimum wages are somewhat different in that they directly raise the cost of labor. Minimum wages that are not too far from the market-clearing competitive level may not do much damage to overall employment, while improving labor conditions somewhat. The same cannot be said of minimum wages that are far above this level. The danger, then, is that many job seekers will be denied opportunities of employment by being priced out of the market. Labor market dualism, whereby a comparably small minority of insiders protect their state-mandated privileges at the expense of a large majority of outsiders, is unfortunately a common feature of economies around the world. This stunts both human development and growth prospects. The bottom line, however, is that basic labor rights, as encapsulated in the International Labor Organization's core conventions, for example, are not an impediment to economic development. They need not be postponed until economic takeoff takes place and is firmly entrenched. History need not be a guide here. Can developing nations emulate the historical pattern? As I mentioned previously, manufacturing is an escalator for poor countries for several important reasons. First, there tends to be a positive productivity dynamic in many manufacturing industries. Establish a beachhead in one of the easy manufacturing sectors, such as garments, and the chances are that you will experience steady increases in productivity and will be able to jump onto other more sophisticated industries in time. Second, manufacturing is a tradable sector. This means that your successful manufacturing industries can expand almost indefinitely by gaining market share in world markets without running into demand constraints. Third, manufacturing is a great absorber of unskilled labor, a low-income country's most plentiful resource. Activities such as garments, footwear, toys, and electronics assembly require few skills, so farmers can easily be transformed into assembly line workers. These are the reasons why, historically, industrialization has been the main engine of rapid economic growth. Productivity convergence, export expansion, and labor absorption create a virtuous cycle that propel the economy forward until the gap with the global frontier closes and the demands of technological progress become substantially greater. Again, that is how things worked in the past. The conventional view is that today's low-income countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America will have to do something similar if they want to experience rapid and sustained economic growth. But this expectation may not be fulfilled. Ours is a very different world. The forces of globalization and technological progress have combined to alter the nature of manufacturing work in a way that makes it very difficult, if not impossible, for latecomers to emulate the industrialization experience of East Asian tigers or the European and North American economies before them. Consider some of the facts. Since the 1960s, every decade has brought lower levels of industrial employment and output as a share of the economy in developing countries, controlling for standard income and demographic determinants. Peak levels of industrialization are lower than ever and are being reached at a fraction of the incomes experienced by previous industrializers. This means that many, if not most, developing nations are becoming service economies without having had a proper experience of industrialization, a process I have called premature deindustrialization. While early industrializers managed to place 30% or more of their workforce in manufacturing, the most recent round of latecomers have rarely managed that feat. Brazil's manufacturing employment peaked at 16%, and Mexico's at 20%. In India, manufacturing employment began to lose ground in relative terms after it reached 13%. Latin America appears to be the worst-hit region, but worryingly similar trends are very much evidenced in sub-Saharan Africa, too, where few countries had much industrialization to begin with. The only countries that seem to have escaped the curse of premature industrialization are a relatively small group of Asian countries and manufacturers' exporters. The advanced countries themselves have experienced significant employment deindustrialization, but manufacturers' output at constant prices has held its own comparatively well in the advanced world, something that is typically overlooked since so much of the discussion on deindustrialization focuses on nominal rather than real values. The reasons behind these trends have to do both with technology and trade. Rapid global technological progress in manufacturing has reduced the prices of manufactured goods relative to services, discouraging newcomers in developing countries from entry. At the same time, manufacturing has become much more capital and skill intensive, substantially reducing the labor-absorbing potential of the sector for workers from agriculture or informality. On the trade front, competition with China and other successful exporters, combined with the reduction in protection levels, means that few poor countries now have the opportunity to develop simple manufactures for home consumption. The room for import substitution was squeezed out. It is not implausible that the East Asian tiger economies will be the last countries to ever experience industrialization in the manner to which economic history has accustomed us. If true, this is bad news for economic growth for all the reasons described earlier. It is also bad news for equity. The chasm in earnings and working conditions between bankers and managers on the one hand and participants in informal activities such as petty trade or household help is incomparably larger in developing countries. Earlier transition to services, prior to substantial accumulation of human capital and institutional capabilities, greatly exacerbates the problems of inequality and exclusion in the labor market with which advanced economies are struggling. Future paths for work. Can this process of premature deindustrialization nonetheless prove to be a blessing in disguise? I noted previously some of the advantages of services in terms of personal autonomy and freedom. James C. Scott notes that a very high percentage of industrial workers in the United States would rather open a shop, restaurant, or work on a farm. The unifying theme of these dreams is the freedom from close supervision and autonomy of the working day that, in their mind, more than compensates for the long hours and risks of such small businesses. Scott contrasts this with the work of a factory setting, where the assembly line is fine-tuned to reduce autonomy to the vanishing point. Perhaps workers in the developing world can somehow take a shortcut and bypass the drudgery of manufacturing. Perhaps, but how such a future can be constructed is not at all clear. A society in which most workers are self-proprietors, shopkeepers, independent professionals, artists, and set their own terms of employment while making an adequate living is feasible only when productivity is very high. High productivity enables the generation of plentiful demand for these services, and correspondingly high incomes for independent proprietors. The trouble is that services, in aggregate, have not experienced nearly as much productivity growth as manufacturing over the course of history. It takes as many waiters to run a restaurant today as it did a century ago. So it has fallen on industrialization to provide the high incomes and demand for the rest of the economy. What is clear, therefore, is that policymakers will face an altogether new challenge when they turn to the future of work and human development. More economic growth will have to come from productivity advances in services. This means, in turn, that the partial sectoral approaches that worked so well to stimulate export-oriented industrialization during the early stages of rapid growth in Asia and beyond will have to be replaced, or at least complemented, by massive economy-wide investments in human capital and institutions. When manufacturing is the engine of the economy, selective reforms such as export incentives, special economic zones, or incentives to foreign investors can be highly effective. After all, it is enough to have a few export successes facing nearly infinite demand on world markets to pull the economy along. But when growth must rely on mostly non-tradable services, selective efforts will not work. Reform efforts will have to be more comprehensive, targeting productivity growth in all services simultaneously. Marx famously envisioned a society in which it would be possible for people to do one thing today and another tomorrow, to hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, rear cattle in the evening, criticize after dinner, without ever becoming hunter, fisherman, herdsman, or critic. A precondition for this, however, was that the productive forces of the economy develop sufficiently. To date, industrial capitalism has been pretty much the only path to a productive society. Factory work was not pleasant, and it generated significant social tensions, as Marx highlighted, but it got the productivity job done. Today, this path looks both less desirable and less feasible. A new path will have to be invented. The broad contours of this alternative are easy to state. It will be a model based on services. It will focus more on soft infrastructure, learning and institutional capabilities, and less on physical capital accumulation, plant and equipment in manufacturing industries. Beyond that, however, much remains up for grabs. Economic and political institutions. For some time now, it has been conventional wisdom that institutions, beyond policy reforms here and there, were central in the process of economic development. Economists focused on two types of institutions in particular, those that protected property rights and those that enforced contracts. Though this was not always explicit, economists also tended to have a universalist conception of institutions, presuming that what worked well in one setting could be transplanted in others. Over time, this best practice mindset would come to dominate the practical and policy work of international organizations such as the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. The detailed, but fairly specific prescriptions of the Washington Consensus would be augmented by open-ended recommendations on reducing corruption, improving regulatory and judicial institutions, and enhancing governance more broadly. In an article published in 2000, I argued that the prevailing technocratic views on institutional reform were missing an important part of the picture. They ignored both the malleability and the context specificity of institutional designs. You can step off a plane in a country you have never been to and spout these commandments: keep inflation low and stable, ensure that entrepreneurs feel safe and can retain the return to their investments, without going wrong. Who would possibly invest in the economy otherwise? We can agree that growth-supporting institutions must perform certain universal tasks, such as safeguarding macroeconomic stability or ensuring that investors do not fear expropriation. These are universal functions in the sense that it is difficult to envisage how any market-based economy can develop in their absence. But these tasks do not tell us much about the form that the requisite institutions should take. As East Asia has amply shown, Market incentives can be generated with institutions that take, from the best practice perspective, highly unusual forms. Even private property rights can be dispensed with, it seems, if there are arrangements, as in the case of China's TVEs, township and village enterprises, that provide effective and substantial control rights to investors. Function does not map into unique forms. I also argued that democracy was a sort of meta-institution, allowing each society to choose and shape its institutions in contextually appropriate ways. China is not a democracy, of course, but its experimental approach to institutional design, ensuring that reforms are locally effective and do not generate large redistributions, mimics in some essential ways how democratic deliberation and decision-making operate. I also provided some cross-national evidence suggesting that democracies do indeed generate high-quality growth, providing greater predictability, stability, and resilience, and better distributional outcomes. When the piece was published, the number of democracies in the world was swiftly rising. Today, by one count, there are more democracies in the world than autocracies, something never experienced before in world history. This is something to be celebrated. But for the world's new democracies, the picture is hardly rosy. Democratic failures. In a prescient article in 1997, Fareed Zakaria wrote about democratically elected regimes routinely ignoring constitutional limits on their power and depriving their citizens of basic rights and freedoms. Observers began to notice most countries with more or less free elections hardly operated along Western lines. Today, experts are more likely to talk of democratic recession than to applaud democracy's advance. Zakaria called these regimes illiberal democracies. As he and others have noted, electoral democracy is different from liberal democracy. Sharon Mukand and I have formalized the difference by distinguishing among three sets of rights. Property rights are rights that protect asset holders and investors against expropriation by the state or other groups. Political rights guarantee free and fair electoral contests and allow the winners of such contests to determine policies subject to the constraints set by other rights, when provided. Civil rights ensure equality before the law, that is, non-discrimination in the provision of public goods such as justice, security, education, and health. Political and civil rights can bleed into each other and be difficult to distinguish, but they are not the same. Tabulations based on Freedom House raw scores, for example, show that it is far more common for countries to provide political rights in the sense defined here than it is for them to provide civil rights. The distinction between political and civil rights allows us to operationalize the difference between electoral and liberal democracies. An electoral democracy provides property and political rights. A liberal democracy provides civil rights in addition. We can classify these countries accordingly. Our classification is based on unpublished Freedom House raw scores. Details are in the original paper. Countries that provide civil rights but no political rights, what we call liberal autocracies, are extremely rare. Britain, in the early 19th century, before the extension of the franchise, is the prime historical example. Perhaps the only contemporary example is the Principality of Monaco. The literature on economic development recognizes, to some extent, the importance of liberal practices by stressing the importance of the rule of law. But when economists and others talk of the rule of law, they often confound two things that are best kept distinct. On the one hand, the weakness of the legal administration and enforcement in poor countries can render judicial remedies against the rights violations and the abuse of power ineffective. On the other, the governing coalition, the majority, can deliberately discriminate against ethnic, religious, or ideological minorities in order to solidify their hold on power or disproportionately divert public goods to their supporters. India ranks low on rule of law indicators, in part because it takes a very long time for courts to reach a verdict, not because the legal regime exhibits explicit bias against members of a certain caste or religion. In Turkey, the rule of law fails whenever government opponents, whether they are secularists, liberals, or Kurdish activists, are on the wrong side of a dispute. Inefficiency and deliberate bias are quite different things. The first can be ameliorated by improved capabilities and enhanced bureaucratic capacity. The second is part and parcel of the deliberate operations of the judicial machinery. Violations of the second type are more insidious and perhaps also more damaging. Rights violations targeting minorities or government opponents become the modus operandi of governments hoping to hold on to power. They also deepen identity and ideological cleavages in society, making the establishment of liberal democracy that much harder. Historically, liberal democracy has never come easy. The United States is perhaps the oldest democracy today, though for all its pretensions, it would have been hard to call the country fully liberal until after the civil rights struggles of the 1960s bore fruit. With the notable exception of Britain, most Western European countries reverted to various forms of autocratic government periodically before the Second World War. The reestablishment of liberal democracy in Western Europe after 1945 was by no means a foregone conclusion, and presumably owes much to the discrediting of the fascist regimes of the pre-war period. Japan, too, was an unlikely success in Asia. We do not have to idealize the political regimes in these advanced post-industrial societies to acknowledge that it has been very difficult to follow their examples in the developing world. The temptations of illiberalism have been evidenced in the post-socialist countries of Eastern and Southeastern Europe as well. Despite membership in the European Union, Hungary is well on its way to becoming a model illiberal democracy. Today, the vast majority of countries that became democratic in the third wave of democratization and thereafter are electoral rather than liberal democracies. Why is liberal democracy so rare? To understand why liberal democracy is such a rare beast, it is useful to consider the circumstances under which countries make a transition from autocracy to democracy. The voluminous literature in political science and political economy on democratic transitions tends to focus on two kinds of processes. The first has to do with splits and bargaining within the elite. When the elite are divided and have a hard time coordinating, democracy can emerge as a system of power sharing. The second has to do with struggles between non-elites and the elite. When the elites can no longer keep non-elites in check, they may prefer to give the non-elites the vote instead of facing the prospect of political instability and mass revolt. The democratic settlements that such transitions produce are unlikely to be liberal. This is because the primary beneficiaries of liberal democracy, as opposed to electoral democracy, are disenfranchised minority groups who hold little power in either kind of settlement. Elites want to protect their property rights first and foremost, and the dominant groups within the non-elite, let us call them the majority, want electoral rights so they can choose policies to their liking. The ethnic, religious, or ideological minorities that would most benefit from non-discrimination will rarely sit at the negotiating table. The political logic of democratization produces electoral rather than liberal democracy. The real puzzle is not that liberal democracy is so rare, but that it exists at all. There are several circumstances that can bend this dismal logic in a direction that is more favorable to liberal democracy. First, there may be reasons why the elite want civil rights in addition to property rights. The landlords and wealthy merchants who prevailed over the king in Britain's glorious revolution sought to protect themselves from the king in both the religious sphere and the economic sphere. They feared James II would impose his Catholicism on them as much as they worried about the crown's ability to expropriate them through exorbitant taxes. So, in Britain, property and civil rights were entrenched together. British liberals would in time make little distinction between these two sets of rights, presuming that they were part and parcel of the same process. T.H. Marshall's famous essay, Citizenship and Social Class, for example, would fold property rights under civil rights. South Africa is a very different case, but the continued and somewhat improbable presence of liberal norms appears to be due to an analogous set of circumstances. At the time of the democratic transition in 1994, the minority government was intent on protecting not only the property rights of the whites, but also their civil rights. As in the Glorious Revolution, the elites shared identity markers with the minority, rendering them easy targets for discrimination and making them particularly interested in safeguarding civil rights. Sadly, liberal norms have been in retreat for a number of years in South Africa. Our Index of Liberal Democracy no longer classifies South Africa as one since 2009. A second path arises when society is relatively homogeneous and there are no marked identity cleavages. In this case, the majority have no clear minority against whom they can discriminate. Liberal democracy and electoral democracy become effectively indistinguishable. Japan and South Korea are perhaps apt illustrations of this model. Finally, it is possible to maintain liberal democracy if there is no clear majority, and if no identifiable group can hope to hold on to power indefinitely. Repeated game incentives may then sustain a regime of moderation and tolerance. Each group respects the rights of others for fear that it, too, may become a minority one day. Such modi vivendi are fragile for a number of reasons. Successful political leaders can forge and sustain majority governing coalitions even when society is divided by multiple cross-cutting cleavages. Such leaders will be less concerned about the rights of groups outside the coalition, even when the nature of the coalition changes over time. Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan provides a good example of this tactic. Alternatively, leaders may simply overestimate how long they will remain in power. In this case, they will overlook that sooner rather than later, they may need the goodwill of today's opposition groups. These problems plague developed and developing countries alike. Liberal democracy in continental Europe, at least until the post-war period, was fragile partly because identity cleavages based on religion, ethnicity, or language competed with affiliations based on income and class. Fascists and Nazis were successful because they could forge large enough governing alliances based on constructed identity narratives that blamed and excluded others, foreigners, Jews, gypsies, and cosmopolitans. But in many respects, the challenges that developing nations face today are much greater. Political disadvantages of backwardness. In the West, liberalism developed and spread before the franchise was expanded. Restraints on the executive, the rule of law, religious tolerance, and free speech were well established in Britain by the early part of the 19th century. Democracy was a latecomer, and liberals themselves were quite dubious about its benefits. The best-known theorist of classical liberalism, John Stuart Mill, thought democracy required a certain level of societal maturity, one that Britain had reached only recently, and that other societies, like Russia or India, lacked. Along with de Tocqueville, he fretted about the tyranny of the masses that elections might bring. As Edmund Fawcett explains, liberals grudgingly made their peace with democracy in the decades before the First World War. They gave their support to the expansion of the franchise, hoping, in return, that popular forces would accept liberal limits on the authority of the people's will. The difference with the developing world could not be bigger. Liberals rarely held the upper hand in developing nations, and there was no liberal tradition to speak of in decolonizing countries before democracy arrived. India is perhaps the exception, thanks to British influence among the elite. Second, the forces of industrialization, which promoted liberal democracy in the West, are much weaker today in the developing world, as we saw earlier in this chapter. Industrialization was important to democracy because it unleashed the social forces that destabilized the old aristocratic order. But it also meant that the main axis of conflict between the elite and non-elite would consist of bread-and-butter issues having to do with pay, labor rights, and taxes and benefits. These were conflicts liberal democracy could handle. Labor market regulations and the welfare state were the upshot. Over time, these institutional innovations would alter the nature of capitalism, but they did not pose a serious threat to liberal practices. In developing countries, mass political mobilization typically took place in very different circumstances. It was the product of decolonization, or wars of national liberation, where the main cleavage was not class, based on economic interests, but identity. Politics revolved around nation-building, with an implicit or explicit other against which mobilized masses were aligned, a colonial adversary, a neighboring nation, or an ethnic group supposedly standing in the way of independence. From the standpoint of politics, identity cleavages are not primordial or independent. They can be deepened or manipulated, spurring political mobilization based on ethnicity, language, or religion. Historical tensions and cultural diversity provide the raw material for clever politicians to fashion electoral majorities. Populism of this kind, populism of the right, differs in one important respect from populism of the left, centered on income and class cleavages. Left populists promise income-boosting or redistributive policies that aim to overcome the income and class cleavages that animate them. Right populists, on the other hand, depend on the continued prevalence and deepening of identity cleavages to maintain their hold on power. So, unlike populism of the left, populism of the right directly blocks the emergence of liberal democracy. The politics of identity can sometimes produce stable arrangements, typically temporary, where, in the absence of a clear majority group, each ethnic or linguistic group can hold on to its rights. Before 1975, Lebanon's consociational democracy was a classic case of this. But once the main political cleavages are identity-based, the political balance is fragile and can be easily destabilized by demographic changes or opportunistic politicians, as indeed happened subsequently in Lebanon with the influx of Jordanian Palestinians and the subsequent civil war. It is true, of course, that by definition, developing countries are still poor, and that the structural changes that today's rich countries underwent during the 19th and early 20th centuries are perhaps still ahead of them. It is also the case that successful industrializers among them have ended up becoming liberal democracies. Consider South Korea or Taiwan. In both cases, industrialization produced a significant working class, which in turn played an important role in democratization. Even more impressive is the case of Mauritius, which is an ethnically divided society but remains a liberal democracy. As in the case of Switzerland, it appears that major identity cleavages are not necessarily an insurmountable obstacle to liberal democracy. But industrialization, and especially the creation of a significant labor movement, seems to be important in opening up space for liberal politics and repressing identity politics. The costs of dictatorship. The degradation of democracy has clear costs for human rights and civil liberties, but it also has less obvious costs for economic performance as well. The relationship between a nation's politics and its economic prospects is one of the most fundamental and most studied subjects in all of social science. Which is better for economic growth? A strong guiding hand that is free from the pressure of political competition, or a plurality of competing interests that fosters openness to new ideas and new political players? East Asian examples, South Korea, Taiwan, and China, seem to suggest the former. But how, then, can one explain the fact that almost all wealthy countries, except those that owe their riches to natural resources alone, are democratic? Should political openness precede rather than follow economic growth? When we look at systematic historical evidence instead of individual cases, we find that authoritarianism buys little in terms of economic growth. For every authoritarian country that has managed to grow rapidly, there are several that have floundered. For every Lee Kuan Yew of Singapore, there are many like Mobutu Sese Seko of the Congo. Democracies outperform dictatorships in long-term economic growth and in several other important respects as well. They provide much greater economic stability, measured by the ups and downs of the business cycle. They are better at adjusting to external economic shocks, such as terms of trade declines or sudden stops in capital inflows. They generate more investment in health and education or human capital, and they produce more equitable societies. Authoritarian regimes, by contrast, ultimately produce economies that are as fragile as their political systems. Their economic potency, when it exists, rests on the strength of individual leaders or on favorable but temporary circumstances. They cannot aspire to continued economic innovation or to global economic leadership. At first sight, China seems to be an exception. Since the late 1970s, following the end of Mao's disastrous experiments, China has done extremely well, experiencing unparalleled rates of economic growth. Even though it has democratized some of its local decision-making, the Chinese Communist Party maintains a tight grip on national politics, and the human rights picture is marred by frequent abuses. But China also remains a comparatively poor country. Its future economic progress depends in no small part on whether it manages to open its political system to competition, in much the same way that it has opened up its economy. Without this transformation, the lack of institutionalized mechanisms for voicing and organizing dissent will eventually produce conflicts that will overwhelm the capacity of the regime to suppress. Political stability and economic growth will both suffer. Still, Russia and China are both large and powerful economies. Their example can sway leaders elsewhere to think that they can aspire to economic ascendancy while tightening the screws on domestic political opposition. Consider Turkey, a rising economic power in the Middle East that seemed destined, until recently, to become the region's sole Muslim democracy. During his first term in office, Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan relaxed some restrictions on Kurdish minorities and passed reforms that aligned the country's legal regime with European norms. But since the late 2000s, Erdogan and his allies have launched a thinly disguised campaign to intimidate their opponents and cement government control over the media and public institutions. Early on, they incarcerated hundreds of military officers, academics, and journalists on fabricated charges of fomenting terror and plotting coups. Once Erdogan broke from his former allies, followers of Fethullah Gulen, the witch hunt turned on the latter, especially after the failed coup of July 2016. More than 100,000 public sector workers were dismissed, and the country became the world's largest jailer of journalists. This rapid slide toward authoritarianism has greatly damaged prospects for the Turkish economy. It will have corrosive effects on the quality of policymaking, as well as undermine Turkey's claim to global economic standing. External observers and financial markets are not always good at reading such political developments. Turkey was still receiving plaudits from Western experts and emerging market analysts long after it became clear that its politics had taken a nasty turn. Brazil's experience provides a sharply contrasting case. Brazil's currency has been hammered since mid-2014, much worse than most other emerging markets, in large part because of the unfolding of a major corruption scandal. Prosecutors there have laid bare a wide-ranging kickback scheme centered on the state oil company Petrobras and involving executives, parliamentarians, and state officials. So it may seem natural that financial markets have been spooked. Yet what we have learned since the corruption story first broke is the remarkable strength of Brazil's legal and democratic institutions rather than their weakness. The prosecutor and judge on the case have been allowed to do their jobs, despite the Dilma Rousseff government's natural instinct to quash the investigation. And from all appearances, the probe follows proper judicial procedures and is not used to advance the political agenda of the government's opponents. Beyond the judiciary, a slew of institutions, including the federal police and the finance ministry, have taken part and worked in sync. Leading businessmen and politicians have been jailed, among them the former treasurer of the ruling Workers' Party. Financial markets are supposed to be forward rather than backward-looking. A proper comparison of Brazil's experience with that of other emerging market economies, where corruption is no less a problem, would, if anything, lead to an upgrade of Brazil's standing. Going back to Turkey, corruption there reaches higher and is more widespread than in Brazil. Leaked phone conversations have directly implicated Erdogan and his family, along with several government ministers, in a hugely lucrative corruption ring revolving around trade with Iran and construction deals. It is an open secret that government procurement has long been used to enrich politicians and their business cronies. Yet today, it is the police officers who led the corruption probe against Erdogan who are in jail. The media outlets that supported the probe have been closed down and taken over by the government. Erdogan has argued that the police officers are followers of Gulen and that the investigation was politically motivated, aiming to unseat Erdogan. Both claims are most likely true, but neither justifies the blatant unlawfulness with which the government has clamped down on the corruption allegations. Turkey's institutions are sinking into a morass that will make recovery very difficult. Brazil's political institutions, on the other hand, will emerge stronger, even though the country has incurred a bigger economic cost in the short term. Does economic development buy good politics? What about the connection in the other direction, from economics to politics? In 2010, just prior to the Arab Spring, the United Nations published its 20th anniversary Human Development Report, HDI. Perhaps the biggest surprise in it was the outstanding performance of the Muslim countries of the Middle East and North Africa. Here was Tunisia, ranked 6th among 135 countries in terms of improvement in its Human Development Index over the previous 4 decades, ahead of Malaysia, Hong Kong, Mexico, and India. Not far behind was Egypt, ranked 14th. The HDI is a measure of development that captures achievements in health and education alongside economic growth. Egypt, and especially Tunisia, did well enough on the growth front, but where they really shone was on these broader indicators. At 74, Tunisia's life expectancy edged out Hungary's and Estonia's, countries that are more than twice as wealthy. Some 69% of Egypt's children were in school, a ratio that matched much richer Malaysia's. Clearly, these were states that did not fail in providing social services or distributing the benefits of economic growth widely. Yet in the end, it didn't matter. The Tunisian and Egyptian people were, to paraphrase Howard Beale, mad as hell at their governments, and they were not going to take it anymore. If Tunisia's Zine El Abidine Ben Ali or Egypt's Hosni Mubarak were hoping for political popularity as a reward for economic gains, they must have been sorely disappointed. One lesson of the Arab Annus Mirabilis, then, is that good economics doesn't always mean good politics. The two can part ways for quite some time. It is true that the world's wealthy countries are almost all democracies, but democratic politics is neither a necessary nor a sufficient condition for economic development over a period of several decades. Despite the economic advances they registered, Tunisia, Egypt, and many other Middle Eastern countries remained authoritarian countries ruled by a narrow group of cronies, with corruption, clientelism, and nepotism running rife. These countries' rankings on political freedoms and corruption stand in glaring contrast to their rankings on development indicators. In Tunisia, Freedom House reported prior to the Jasmine Revolution, the authorities continue to harass, arrest, and imprison journalists and bloggers, human rights activists, and political opponents of the government. The Egyptian government was ranked 111th out of 180 countries in Transparency International's 2009 survey of corruption. And of course, the converse is also true. India has been democratic since the independence in 1947, yet the country didn't begin to escape its low Hindu rate of growth until the early 1980s. A second lesson is that rapid economic growth on its own does not buy political stability unless political institutions are allowed to develop and mature rapidly as well. In fact, economic growth itself generates social and economic mobilization, a fundamental source of political instability. As the late political scientist Samuel Huntington put it more than 40 years ago, social and economic change, urbanization, increases in literacy and education, industrialization, mass media expansion, extend political consciousness, multiply political demands, broaden political participation. Now add social media such as Twitter and Facebook to the equation, and the destabilizing forces that rapid economic change sets into motion can become overwhelming. These forces become most potent when the gap between social mobilization and the quality of political institutions widens. When a country's political institutions are mature, they respond to demands from below through a combination of accommodation, response, and representation. When they are underdeveloped, they shut those demands out in the hope that they will go away or be bought off by economic improvements. The events in the Middle East amply demonstrate the fragility of the second model. Protesters in Tunis and Cairo were not demonstrating about lack of economic opportunity or poor social services. They were rallying against a political regime that they felt was insular, arbitrary, and corrupt, and that did not allow them adequate voice. A political regime that can handle these pressures need not be democratic in the Western sense of the term. One can imagine responsive political systems that do not operate through free elections and competition among political parties. Some would point to Oman or Singapore as examples of authoritarian regimes that are durable in the face of rapid economic change. Perhaps so. But the only kind of political system that has proved itself over the long haul is that associated with Western democracies. Which brings us back to China. At the height of the Egyptian protests, Chinese web surfers who searched the term Egypt or Cairo were returned messages saying that no results could be found. Evidently, the Chinese government did not want its citizens to read up on the Egyptian protests and get the wrong idea. With the memory of the 1989 Tiananmen Square movement ever present, China's leaders are intent on preventing a repeat. China is not Tunisia or Egypt, of course. The Chinese government has experimented with local democracy and has tried hard to crack down on corruption. Even so, protest has spread over the last decade. There were 87,000 instances of what the government calls sudden mass incidents in 2005, the last year that the government released such statistics, which suggests that the rate has since increased. Dissidents challenge the supremacy of the Communist Party at their peril. The Chinese leadership's gamble is that a rapid increase in living standards and employment opportunities will keep the lid on simmering social and political tensions. That is why it is so intent on maintaining high rates of economic growth and props up public and private investment through credit. But the Arab Spring sent a sobering message to China and other authoritarian regimes around the world. Don't count on economic progress to keep you in power forever. Substitutes for classical liberal politics. The developments I have discussed in this chapter, and the reality of premature deindustrialization in particular, makes for rather poor prospects for liberal democracy in developing countries. Could there be alternative paths to liberal democracy that do not rely on mass industrialization or prior experience with liberalism? Perhaps today's developing countries can still get there, even though they will necessarily take a different road. Let me draw an analogy with economic reform. It was Alexander Gershenkron's enduring insight that latecomers in the economic development game would have to rely on institutions quite a bit different from those that had worked well in early industrializers. This insight has been vindicated time and again in the developing world. Economic growth miracles happened not where policymakers slavishly copied policies and institutional arrangements from the West, but where they crafted new arrangements more appropriate to their conditions. China has been a master of that game, but the point applies equally well to South Korea, Taiwan, or Mauritius, where heterodox development strategies prevailed early on. As we've already repeatedly seen so far, the market economy admits a wide variety of institutional possibilities. Could there be a similar possibility with political reform? Can something that looks like liberal democracy, equal treatment before the law, be achieved without Western-style institutions, an independent judiciary, for example, or separation of church and state? Consider the system in Lebanon as it operated prior to the country's civil war in 1975. The regime that had been created in 1943 by a national pact between the Muslim and Christian communities looked, in some respects, as the antithesis of a liberal regime. Instead of disregarding religious differences, the regime explicitly apportioned public offices among religious denominations. At the apex of the political system, the presidency was allocated to a Christian Maronite, the premiership to a Muslim Sunni, and the speakership to a Muslim Shiite. This principle extended downward to other government positions. As long as the system was stable, the country was regarded as a model democracy in a region sorely lacking in liberal politics. Political scientists counted it, alongside Austria and Switzerland, among the world's liberal democracies. It was a non-liberal arrangement that nevertheless produced a liberal outcome. An important reason that developing countries have difficulty sustaining liberal regimes is that they lack agencies of restraint. Elected governments can do whatever they want, and if courts or the media stand in their way, they can easily manipulate those too. Paul Collier has suggested that there is one important and powerful institution that can often fill the gap. The military. As Collier argues, the military is often the only well-trained meritocratic institution with an esprit de corps that favors interests of the country as a whole rather than a particular ethnic or religious group. Perhaps it can act as the institution of restraint for elected governments in countries where the judiciary is not up to the task. Such an arrangement, of course, is at best a mixed blessing. The pros and cons have been easy to observe in Turkey. On the one hand, the military did prevent, while it was powerful, religious sectarian political groups from becoming dominant. It did promote a kind of procedural legalism and rule of law, to the point that it buckled rather than be perceived to act unlawfully when those same legal instruments were used against it in a series of sham trials. At the same time, the military had its own ideology of intolerance. For observant Muslims or Kurdish nationalists, the Turkish Republic was hardly liberal, and the frequent interruptions of civilian politics prevented the long-term institutionalization of political parties and the development of a culture of political compromise and moderation. As a third example, consider the future direction that China's political regime may take. Might the country possibly develop a more liberal regime while retaining the monopoly of the Communist Party? One can envisage a sort of Singapore writ large, where political competition takes place within the dominant political party, and judicial institutions are effective in enforcing the rule of law. One can think of many reasons why such a regime might fall far short of the standards of liberal democracy we are accustomed to in the West, but as in China's imperfect market economy, the outcome may be better than the most likely alternative. Fourth, there is the media. We are accustomed to think of a free press as the sine qua non of a liberal democracy. But what if the bulk of mainstream media, as in many developing and some advanced economies, is bankrolled and controlled by business interests who have little interest in presenting fair and balanced views? What if a sensationalist media plays up and aggravates identity cleavages to maximize its readership? The usual answer to such dilemmas is to call for more competition in media markets. But in the real world, there is no guarantee that this solves the problem. We cannot rule out the possibility that more aggressive regulation of the media than would be acceptable in the West might sometimes provide a better outcome. As I have argued throughout, market-supporting institutions can take diverse institutional forms. We should not be institutional purists. These considerations lead me to think that the same may be true, perhaps, of liberal democracy-supporting institutions, too. Perhaps liberalism admits diverse institutional forms. I hasten to add that I am considerably less sure of this point than I was of my original argument in the domain of economics. I would certainly like to see more examples of heterodox liberal democracy before I would push this idea strongly. But to remain optimistic about the prospects for liberal democracy, we need to at least entertain the idea that there may be a gist of truth to it. Chapter 5. Economists and their models. Economists have played a big part in constructing the world in which we live. They have provided the intellectual constructs, narratives, and justifications for the arrangements that have underpinned the liberal, or neoliberal, if you prefer, international economic order of the last few decades. Will they also play a part in its destruction, or will they help redesign it, thereby saving it from its own extremes and contradictions? Economics is a science that can be tremendously powerful and useful, but at the hands of its practitioners it often goes wrong, as it did in preparing the ground for the global financial crisis and pushing for an unsustainable, unhealthy model of globalization. Where did we go wrong? Why, to take one prominent problem discussed here, were economists so dismissive of the distributional consequences of trade agreements, consequences that their own models had predicted so well? Hubris, overconfidence, and naive politics are all to blame, but perhaps the most surprising answer offered here is that economists are often not true to their own discipline and training. Economists often forget, especially when they engage in public debates, that economics is not a set of predetermined conclusions or policy prescriptions, but a highly context-specific discipline that provides only contingent answers. There is virtually no question in economics to which "it depends" is not an appropriate answer. Of course, the strength of economics is that we can usually also tell precisely what it depends on. Many of the difficulties economists run into, as this chapter illustrates, derive not from taking economics too seriously, but from not taking it seriously enough. Economists are often dragged into public debates by the policy relevance of their work, but they are rarely very self-conscious about their public responsibility. Should they shade their answers if they worry that what they say will be hijacked by special interest groups? If an unsavory dictator's son asks them for help developing his country's economy, should they accept? Should they just say, "I don't know," when their science has not developed strong evidence, and let others with even worse understanding take over the public conversation? If economists want to enhance their public engagement, they will need to pay greater attention to these and other questions discussed in the next few chapters. Nobel confusion? When the 2013 Nobel Prize in Economics, technically the Sveriges Riksbank Prize in Economic Sciences in memory of Alfred Nobel, was awarded to Eugene Fama and Robert Schiller, along with Lars Peter Hansen, many were puzzled by the selection. Fama and Schiller are both distinguished and highly regarded scholars, so it was not their qualifications that raised eyebrows. What seemed odd was that the committee had picked them together. The two economists seemed to hold diametrically opposed views on how financial markets work. Fama, the University of Chicago economist, is the father of the efficient market hypothesis, the theory that asset prices reflect all publicly available information, with the implication that it is impossible to consistently beat the market. Schiller, the Yale economist, meanwhile, has spent much of his career demonstrating that financial markets work poorly. They overshoot, are subject to bubbles, sustained rises in asset prices that cannot be explained by fundamentals, and are often driven by behavioral rather than rational forces. Could both be right? Was the Nobel Committee simply hedging its bets? We can't read the jury's mind, but its selection highlighted a central feature of economics, and a key difference between it and the natural sciences. Economics deals with human behavior, which depends on social and institutional context. That context, in turn, is the creation of human behavior, purposeful or not. This implies that propositions in economic science are typically context-specific rather than universal. The best and most useful economic theories are those that draw clear causal links from a specific set of contextual assumptions to predicted outcomes. So financial markets behave sometimes like Fama's theory, and sometimes like Schiller's. The value of their respective theories is that they discipline our understanding of what type of financial market behavior to expect under specific conditions. Ideally, they also help us choose which model theory we should apply in a particular conjuncture, although this happens too rarely, as we will find out later. Aptly, the third laureate, Lars Peter Hansen, was given his prize for devising statistical techniques to test whether markets behave in a fully rational fashion. What is true of finance is true also of other fields within economics. Labor economists focus not only on how trade unions can distort markets, but also how, under certain conditions, they can enhance productivity. Trade economists study how globalization can reduce or increase, as the case may be, inequality within and across countries. Open economy macroeconomists examine conditions under which global finance stabilizes or destabilizes national economies. Development economists study conditions under which foreign aid does and does not reduce poverty. Training in economics.